Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 157. My word, we've got through a few. And none are better than this one. This one means a lot to me. We kind of recorded it on the fly. I'll explain. Wayne had emailed me a few months back, telling kind of his story a little and asking if I'd be interested in chatting about it on the podcast. And I was, but he's busy, I'm busy, and nothing had happened. And then there was this particular weekend where I'd been filming in Leeds. He lives in Leeds, but he works nights and I was filming in the day. So there was this particular weekend, he was like, dude, I'm going to be in London. And I was like, dude, I'm going to be in Leeds. So it was annoying. But then I wrapped early that week on the film. So I found myself in London on the Friday night. So I messaged him saying, are you going to be about? And we arranged to meet up on the Saturday. Long, rambly story there. But it meant that I only had my mobile gear. I didn't have my Polaroid camera, so I had to take a separate picture. And it also meant that I wasn't as prepared as I'd like to be. So I was concerned it might not be as strong an episode. But I couldn't be happier with the way he spoke and the story he told. Wayne was a soldier. And it's kind of about that. It's about the army. It's about joining the army. It's not anti-army or anti-war or anything. In fact, we go into all that. So I'm just going to stop talking and let you get into the podcast. This is episode 157 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Wayne Sharrocks. It's a child soldier special. Enjoy. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. I mean, I've started recording now, so we're kind of okay. in the bit. No, this is that's a good point. We were just discussing beforehand how this has come together a bit last minute, because we talked about this on email a good month or two ago, right?
Yeah.
And then it's kind of where I've been filming. It was definitely a subject that I wanted to discuss because it's one that fascinates me. And I'd said to you, look, I will get back to you on this at some point, I promise. And then I went quiet for about a month, I'd imagine. And then, I was filming in Leeds. And the long story short is I wasn't expecting to be in London today, and I am, and you're in London. So we said, look, let's swoop on it now. So it's slightly unprepared. But what I know about you, I know your name's Wayne.
Yeah, that's a good start,
right? And basically, the main stuff that I know is I've watched the trailer for the film you're making. And I mean, we'll get into everything, but a brief summary of what I've seen is you joined the army, you know, at a young age.
Yeah.
And at this point, you're not sure if that was a good thing or a good idea. It was fascinating. I had Huey Morgan on a while ago, and I love Huey, and I wasn't sure how he'd be talking about previously being a Marine.
Right.
And he's got that thing of he's like, they're my brothers, I love them, but a lot of them are fucked up, and it fucked him up a lot. And it's done him a lot of damage. And that was good to hear, because I know, I don't know, there's often a sense of pride and loyalty to just be, I don't want to say anything negative about the armed forces and that kind of thing. So, I mean, let's kind of go all the way back. So your name's Wayne Sharrocks?
Sharrocks, yeah.
Sharrocks, I wasn't sure on pronunciation.
Yeah, I think everyone seems to get it wrong. Yeah, they either call me Sharrock or something like that. Yeah, I never get it right,
So have you always lived in Leeds, in the north, up that way?
No, so actually my dad was in the army as well. So,
oh, wow.
My dad joined at 16 himself, and he rose all the way to captain, so he went all the way through the ranks.
Yeah.
And in doing that, we sort of moved around. Every 2 years we moved, so by the time I joined the army, I'd have moved at least, 10, 11 times. And
oh, wow.
So I've lived in places like Northern Ireland, Germany, a lot down south, actually. But then I ended up living in Harrogate for the most time.
Yeah.
Which is where I sort of stuck to until I joined the army myself. Then I went down to Wales. But
yeah.
So now I sort of reside around Harrogate, but soon to move to Stratford.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Well, you're moving about.
Mm.
That's always good. So, I mean, so you were, from an early age, you were exposed to kind of a bit, I'd imagine, of the reality of the armed forces and army life and
I suppose,
and the
movement.
Because again, the fact is, it's regardless of whether or not you're deployed, I guess it's a full life commitment. As you said, it's taking your family and moving here for this amount of time and there for that much. So outside of the stuff you wouldn't have known as a child, you knew that, I guess you would have seen that it was something that when your dad joined, he joined. You know, that was it. He was, that was the priority for you and your family, I guess.
The priority for the family was really his career, I guess. That's how I saw it as a kid.
Yeah.
And yeah, my mum really struggled to gain careers in places because, you know, without doubt, we'd be moving every 2 years.
Yeah.
I think growing up as well, there's a sense of actually I enjoyed moving around because it was like seeing new places and each new place would have something different about it or something. Or, you know, when I was a kid, it was this place had, you know, better parks or something, or better swings, you know, small things. But as you get older, you know, I don't know, better places to go out with your friends or something.
Yeah, that's great. And it's an interesting one. I mean, it sounds stupid, but I've always been pleased that I went to a secondary school that I had to get a train to.
Right. Because
it's easy, particularly in small towns, to live a lot of your life in that small town and never going outside of it. But because from the age of whatever age that is, 10, 11 or something, I was having to get a train every day.
Yeah.
I was then predisposed to getting the train into London or into Southend or into wherever my excitement and nights out or wherever else, rather than just, oh, we go up the road or we go down the road and that's about it. So that must have been a good thing that you're, from an early age, you're kind of, you're trained in going to new places and moving
around. I think there's definitely good things. Like, you know, I'm used to moving around and going to new places, but there's bad things as well. So, like, I haven't got a set of friends that I've had from, you know, when I was a kid, stuff like that. You know, most people have got, you know, their mate, Sam, or whoever it is. It's that they've known since, you know, they were six and they've grown up together and they're always in contact. You know, I haven't got any of that, really. All my friends are sort of, and I'm, but in a sense, it's sort of good because when I do move on, I find it quite easy to detach in a weird way. Which can be good and can be bad, but
mate, it's an odd one because I, again, these are going to sound like weird comparisons, but I had a relationship a good few years back, and it ended, and because it was someone who lived in another country, the beauty of just a simple unfollow on social media made it quite easy to detach because you had that kind of, all right, that's it now. We're not going to bump into each other every other week or be seen out with other groups of friends or have that awkwardness. So. I guess particularly when you were moving around a lot as a kid, it was pre-social media, so you wouldn't have had those easy connections. It's that thing of if you wanted to stay in touch with someone, you were going to be pen pals and stuff like that. So if you've not been there that long, then you might not be the kind of person who's instantly striking up, we'll keep in touch.
I think I was always in my head as well. As soon as I met a new person, it was always in my head. I wouldn't like think about it consciously, but in my head, this is a 2 year relationship.
Yeah.
And as soon as this 2 years is over, we're going to move on, probably not see each other again.
So
I guess I've always had that kind of attitude to life. Even now, sometimes I think that, you know, when I stay in one place, I think, oh, I'm going to have to move out somewhere. Or, I've never lived in one place for more than 2 years, I don't think, ever. I'm 27
weird,
now.
Isn't it? Yeah. That's weird. That's, it's habitual, I guess. Yeah. So was it always 2 years? 2 year postings or whatever.
Well, it was then. It's not so much anymore. But when my dad was in, it was always 2 year postings because he was like, they call it a career soldier. So he'd always have to go in like to training establishments or you know, go out of his battalion to do other jobs and stuff. So he'd quite often be moving around, you know, the country doing stuff. But for me, when I only moved twice, two different camps. So I think they're doing that more in the army now to keep people in, essentially. You know, so they don't have to move around so much.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. So I mean, as a kid, again, it's often the way that we go, I don't know, I guess it's either, but it's often that we don't go the same route as our, or more often now, we don't go the same route as our parents. I always have people ask, oh, like, are your parents musical or anything?
So,
no, neither of my parents have ever played an instrument done anything like that. But so, were you from an early age intrigued by the army and thinking that you would go that route?
I guess from a very, very early stage, I think I was the same as all kids. You know, like I wanted to be a fireman or a Batman was a big influence to me, actually.
Yeah.
But I never saw myself as going in the army, maybe. I just I don't think I was thinking of careers. I just found it fun.
Yeah.
And also, having my dad in the army, I was also, there's a lot of open days and stuff like that where I could go. And I'd actually see inside the camps what most people couldn't see, and have different relationships where people had known my dad. And I remember once, for example, there was an open day in the camp for all the pab rats. So a pab rat is the son of a soldier. So the people who live on the pads estates, it's called.
Right, right.
And so we'd all go on there. My dad, so we all went in uniform, and my dad actually sewed on some of his like sergeant stripes at the time.
Amazing.
And I remember walking around the camp and saying, "No, oh, I outrank this guy," and people telling me to shut up and stuff, and knowing it was Mal, that's Sharrock's his son or something.
Yeah.
So that was quite funny. But so I guess I was excited by it because, you know, it is exciting when you're a kid, isn't it? Go running around, it's all made exciting. You know, they're not going to give you the worst bits; they're going to show you all the fun bits.
Yeah.
And then as I grew sort of older, I sort of got out of that and become a bit more into like music. I was a big Nirvana fan, and I started playing the drums. Then I got into like skateboarding, and then I was convinced I was going to be a professional skateboarder. You know, right, all these sort of things in your mind. And
again, I mean, that's the perfect a rally against your parents. So
dad's
a career soldier. I'm going to be a skateboarder.
Yeah. I used to have like long hair as well. So I had like hair down to my shoulders. And I remember my dad coming back and saying, "Oh, cut your hair like a girl" and stuff like this.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess it was a rebel against my parents.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I decided to join the army, it was sort of like I would have been 14, 15. So coming towards the end of school. And it's that sort of time where you have to make a decision for the rest of your life, don't you?
As in, they certainly imply that.
Yeah, you sort of feel that way. And I wasn't very good academically, so I was in all the lowest sets for everything.
Yeah.
And at school, I was always saw school as, you know, the lowest sets, they were going to be, you know, I'm a hospital porter at the minute, so that's what I was going to do, that type of job. Or the top sets were going to be MPs, lawyers, or whatever. Yeah. So I felt I was already ranked in this system.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to do well, so... And having a dad in the army and saw my dad sort of doing well and rising through the ranks, I thought, well, this is a way I can use my, you know, physical. Yeah, I've always been fit, like quite naturally fit and active, and I was into outdoors and rock climbing and all this type of stuff. So I thought, you know, maybe I could channel that energy and actually get a good career out of my physical attributes rather than my academic attributes. So, and also the catalyst for that was seeing sort of around that time is when like 9/11 happened and the Iraq war was kicking off. And I remember being sat downstairs of the house and seeing this documentary about the Iraq War. And I think it was a Black Watch or something. They got stuck out there for ages and they kept on not getting sent home or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember seeing this documentary and it just, something clicked in me that I thought, right, that is exactly what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
This is, in my mind at the time, you know, now it's ISIS, then it was like Al-Qaeda or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, right, I want to fight these guys. These guys are destroying our way of life and all this type of stuff was eating in my mind.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is what I can do to, you know, help the country, I guess.
Yeah, to do my bit.
Yeah, I'm fit enough. I've got a dad that is good in the army. He can teach me stuff and give me links in places.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I tried to join the army at 15 years and... I think 15 years and 9 months is the youngest you can join. And that's when you go to the Army Foundation College.
Young though, isn't it?
It's as really well young, yeah.
And as said, particularly because I remember at that point the pressure to know what you want to do for the rest of your life, which again is ludicrous because as we all become grown-ups you realize it can be a lot later, you realize, or you can never realize what you actually want to do, but the pressure at that point is that you should know now, and there's a careers advisor who has talked to you for 20 minutes and is going to give you advice on what you can or can't do. And
also there's a kind of pressure between your friends. You know, you don't want to be the only friend that's going to nothing.
He's not doing anything,
You know, everyone's going, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And you don't want to be that guy that's, I'm just going to go live with my parents. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah,
you know?
And weirdly, I mean, and we'll get into this later on maybe as well, the way the army is marketed and presented in this country, intentionally or unintentionally, it is one that's kind of an exciting and cool thing for kids. We play army as kids. We have Action Man toys. There was a podcast recently on the network, on the Hardcore Listing podcast, and a guy was picking his top... Riker, an artist, was picking his top five action toys, and Action Man and G.I. Joe and that were in there.
Because
you could have... Because it was one of the most affordable toys.
Right.
So this army thing, so He-Man and wrestling toys were kind of more expensive, whereas you could get all these different army figures and the tanks and the cars and play that from a very early age, and regardless of wealth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it is a weird one that's... There's when in reality, it's, and again, we'll get into this a lot, but in reality, it's got to be one of the most serious jobs that you can get, and one of the most intense and heavy jobs. But again, it's all you think of is a soldier. I want to be a soldier.
Yeah, exactly.
Along there with fireman or policeman, which again, equally, they're very intense and serious jobs. Yet,
yeah.
I guess it's important in a way. I guess that kind of childhood propaganda makes sense in some ways, because particularly in the past, we really needed as many soldiers as possible, and we needed as many firemen as possible. So if it's marketed as, oh God, this is a tough job, then no one's going to want to do it. Whereas if you grow up with that ingrained in you, that this is a good thing for you to do, you're a good person if you're doing this, then
I think that's never been more so than now, I don't think. Now it's, I think when I was a kid, there was no essence of a soldier being heroic or a hero.
Yeah.
I think you saw them as good citizens or people that were doing something, you know, for the society, but there wasn't this aspect that there is now of hero. You know, every time you see a soldier in the newspaper, it's always prefaced or prefaced by hero soldier, you know, our soldier is another one. There's a lot of that going about.
I mean, it's a tough one that I end up not talking about online much because I get into arguments over it because it's hard to articulate. And equally, I don't want to at any point be disrespectful to those that are heroes, but I've struggled with a charity I've never worked with is Help for Heroes, and I've got a lot of mates who do work with them, and I appreciate what they're doing and what their action is, but for me there's that slight issue that it's, how to word this, not every soldier is a hero.
Yeah,
and that sounds harsh and horrible,
I think that's the issue there, exactly what you're doing there. It's hard to say what you want to say because people have an instant reaction.
Yeah,
to
how
it.
Dare you?
Yeah.
These people are saving. It's but exactly again, it is a tough one, and there have
it's
been,
almost personalised.
In my lifetime alone, there have been horrific things happen at war, actions done by people fighting for our side that have done some horrible and horrific things that I wouldn't consider heroic. Therefore, I struggle, and again, even just even removing that personal side of it, there's been wars and engagements that I haven't agreed with, that I've protested against.
Yeah.
Therefore, it seems odd to me to then go, "Oh, they're all heroes, though." And again, I wanted to have this discussion because it is a really tough subject. Because I don't want to be disrespectful to anyone who's given their life or just their time or their effort or whatever else, but.
Yeah.
It's a weird combination that I said we it's quite a common British public belief to be against war, against these certain invasions.
Yeah.
Yet it's far less publicly expressed to be against soldiers in any way, and it's like, they're all part of that same thing, right?
It is definitely a very tough thing. I think there's part of it. The media definitely has played a big part in it. And there was a report, and I can't remember the exact name of the report, but it's something like. Recognition into our armed forces, and Gordon Brown did it in 2006, I think.
Yeah.
And in it was a 40 suggestions to Gordon Brown of how to get better recognition of armed forces. So one of them was things like Armed Forces Day. So there was never such thing as an Armed Forces Day until 2009. And it started off as Veterans Day in 2006, and they changed it to Armed Forces Day to because at the time, you know, Iraq, and like you say, a lot of people was opposed to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they wanted to get more of a public, you know, heroic status for soldiers. So things like that, increased combined cadet forces in schools.
Right.
So in a lot of schools now, it's almost mandatory that they've got these things in schools.
Wow.
And kids actually get points on there. I don't know how exactly it works, but I know they get some sort of points as if they go on these away days that counts on their like CV or something.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's that type of pressure there.
That's interesting.
There's all sorts of things on there, but it was an effort directed at making soldiers in that way. It's quite an Americanism. America, you know, if you go on a bus and you say you're a veteran, they'll be like, "Ah, thanks for your service." So there's a veteran on board.
100%,
But that was never like that in the UK. But I think they've just tried to Americanize it now. So exactly like you say, it's hard to even say anything negative about a soldier or. It's very, very difficult, and it's a personal subject. It's almost like if you say something about the army, you're instantly calling, I don't know, Sally's brother who's in the army.
Yeah.
And it's personal, you know, and it's not personal.
Yeah, yeah. Completely. It's interesting, the Americanization of it, and again, it's weird comparisons, but I was listening to it recently, and on that podcast about toys, they talked about how when Action Force launched in the UK, it was all kind of British soldiers and British ranks and things like that. And the company who do G.I. Joe in America took over Action Force, but didn't change it to G.I. Joe immediately, because in the UK we didn't know what GIs were particularly. So they kind of started to gradually make it this Americanized version of these army soldiers, until it was G.I. Joe, the Action Force.
Right.
That was then, we've got this big... And again, they are all these big, strong heroes of men. So it went from this almost military replication toys to, you know, trying to be, here's a certain rank, here's another rank, kind of faceless as such, to here's a hero, here's G.I. Joe, a specific guy.
Exactly,
that's
his
name. Mm. And here's this. And it came over to that.
There was actually a set of toys licensed by the MOD called HM Armed Forces, which are really like hyper-realistic toys of British soldiers. So they were like, they wore the exact same boots, had the same rifles, the same helmets, and there was like exactly like the stuff you get in the British Army. You could get like Apache attack helicopters, tanks, we make it assault vehicles. And I was speaking to someone before, and he does a lot of artwork, like sort of anti-military stuff.
Right.
But he's done a lot of research into advertising, because originally he wanted to go into advertising. Darren Cullen, his name is. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about this thing called neuromarketing, which is where they essentially learn how the brain works and use that, I'll say, not against you, or they use that to sell you stuff. So you see that on, so McDonald's is a really good example. So if you get a child as young as possible to think that McDonald's is a fun, cool, a really cool place to eat, it's really nice.
It's a treat.
It's a treat, and you get a free toy. You're more likely to get that child as a repeat customer for life, because the idea has been injected so young that it's formed as in their brain as a thing.
Yeah, completely. And
the military does that same thing. So there was a quote from the ex head of Army recruitment or Army recruitment strategy, and he said it starts with a 7-year-old child seeing a parachutist at an air show and saying, "Oh, that looks great," and then from then on, it's drip, drip, drip through the things, drip, drip, drip. So that idea of getting someone as young as possible and inject it in their mind. The army is this fun, is this heroic thing?
Yeah,
is a definite thing that is done on purpose.
And it's interesting that it's the fun element, because I remember that at Summer Fates or whatever.
Yeah,
an army guy parachuting in, and you buy the little army toys that have the plastic parachute and things like that, and it's this great, cool, exciting thing. But it's removing any of the reality of it.
Exactly.
So, so what was your kind of recruitment into it? Was there active recruitment at your school, or was it, I mean, simply the fact that you're in a unique situation where your dad has been doing this his whole life, so there's that the direct route, I guess?
Well, I think there was a bit of both. I'm pretty sure we had an army recruiter come into school, and I definitely through my dad, it was probably the best way I could get, because he would get me recruitment material, he'd get me the DVDs on different things. And I remember actually having a DVD, the British recruiting DVD at the time, and obsessively watching it. Like, you remember those little DVD players you used to be able to get, like a small laptop?
Yeah.
And you just put a DVD and press play. I remember sitting in bed and just pressing play and just watching all of that on repeat, like, every night.
Wow.
I'd say for a good few months, just like, because I was just obsessed with it. Everything about the army, I just wanted to know everything. And
it's self-brainwashing in many ways, isn't it? It's
really
getting
that
over and over and over.
Yeah,
and
until I just knew everything, and I was obsessed to join the army. That was all I wanted to do. And at that point, I just basically sacked off everything at school. And all I was saying to people is, you know, I don't care about GCSEs. I'm joining the army, so I don't need them. And then I went to apply for Harrogate Foundation College, and I failed because I used to get migraines. I used to go, like, blind in a bit of my eye.
Right.
I used to get this, like, circular, weird thing, and I couldn't see properly in people's faces as that merging up. So I couldn't get in, and I was devastated. And then at that point, I had to move to Northern Ireland because my dad was moving out there. So that sort of even hyper motivated me even more, because the whole political aspect out there in Northern Ireland, and also I was living in a gated military camp where there was armed gates on the end of my street and stuff like that, so that just sparked me up even more.
Yeah.
And I went to
and when was that, kind of early 2000s?
Yeah, so
I'm
it would have been 2006-ish.
Yeah, so it would have been still levels of militarisation out there, and at least if nothing else, all the murals and stuff like that were just mind-blowing. I remember when me and Dan Lasak in 2006 or 2007 did a couple of gigs in Belfast and in Derry, and we had people coming up to us and saying, like, thanks for coming out, because at that point bands weren't going there, really, because it was still seen, even though it's that far on, it was still seen as a dangerous place. And we were like, look, in reality, we didn't even think about it. So it wasn't bold statement on our part, but it was like, well, mate, it meant that every time we did go to Ireland, we made sure we went to Republic and to Northern, like, rather than just going to Dublin, as a lot of bands do, because of that chance going there and it meaning a lot to people. It then meant that every time we went, we were like, we've got to do both. And that was amazing. I mean, particularly when we'd take American supports with us. So we took a guy called B. Dolan with us, who actually I did a song on my solo record called Soldier Boy. And it's about...
Oh, I've heard it.
It's about that. It's about the kind of the confusion of recruitment and the confusion of hero versus villain and so on and so forth. So he was blown away by the murals and all of this everything still so fresh and so stained in blood still, as harsh as it sounds. So I can completely imagine how when you're already motivated to be part of something in that way, to go somewhere that's got such a rooting in it, it'd drive you even more.
And I think as well, with, because you're sort of seeing it from another side as well, so you're seeing, so I was in an army camp, there was places where we got told we wasn't allowed to go. These are called like red areas.
Yeah.
And to me, those people in the red areas were, you know, there was scum that was trying to kill us or something.
Right,
you know, that was in my head, that was what it was. I was constantly seeing the army all the time. Also, my dad, seeing him, like, there was just all that type of thing going on that just hyper-motivated me even more. And the fact that I'd failed the first time, it meant, you know, the one thing I never wanted to do in front of my dad was fail in front of him, you know.
Right.
Especially because he'd go in the army, that would have been, that's devastating. So
I
thought the next time, there's no way I'm failing. So I just did everything I could, you know, I was going for runs all the time and getting all the information off my dad I could, and, you know, just constantly. Actually, my dad took me on the ranges one day. This is before I joined the army. There's a picture, sometimes I do talks and stuff.
Yeah.
And I drag up a picture. There's one of me when I was like two, wearing my dad's beret. And I say, you know, how young I was introduced to the army. There's one of me and my dad, I think I would have been about 16.
Yeah.
Of me and my dad on the ranges, firing rifles. Wow. So he was quite, you know, I think he always, to be fair to him, he did always tell me to get a trade, not join the infantry.
Yeah.
But, you know, as at that sort of age, you want to be, you're either going all in or nothing, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. So what was the process? You kind of got your second go at it.
Yeah.
And succeeded that time. So what was, like, how old were you, and then what was the process?
So I was just turned 17, and then, because I'd done it before, I had to wait 18 months. So literally the day 18 months hit, I went straight to the careers office. And then you have to do some tests. They do like a Barb's test, so there'll be things come up on a screen and it'll say Tom is faster than Wayne, who is faster, and you've got to like pick one of them, and there's all these type of little mental things that are fairly easy.
It's Tom, right? Nailed it. Go ahead.
And then you go to a selection centre, so it's like a day and a half where you do like a mile and a half run, some fitness tests, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I got given my do you swear you're for allegiance? No, you don't swear you're for allegiance. Then you have an interview and stuff, and you decide what you want to join. And then you go away and you come back, sign your oath of allegiance, and swear that to the Queen and all that type of stuff. And then I was in the army about maybe a month or two later. Yeah,
that's amazing. That's incredibly quick, isn't it?
Really quick. Yeah.
And I mean, despite coming from an army family, how much at that point did you actually know? With regards to how long you're in, what you're signing up for, essentially, because again, it is quite a vague thing. You think join the army, is there big discussions on, well, here's how long you're in for, here's how you leave, how you don't leave, you know, all of these things.
That's a good question, because none of that entered my mind at the time. So when I went to the careers office, I didn't ask, you know, how much I was getting paid. That wasn't I wasn't interested in that. I wasn't interested in, you know, how many days off I'd get, even where I'd be based in the country or abroad. I was interested in what regiment I wanted to join.
It's the first questions in any other job, isn't it?
Yeah, it's strange.
Pay and holiday and stuff like that. As silly as that sounds, even if it's a dream job, the pay and holiday is still an important thing to be. What's that going to be?
Which is strange, because I'm just getting a new job now, and a lot of the things, because all the jobs I've had since I've left the army have just been, you know, I've had to do them. Usually worked in agencies.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't got much education, so I've had to do, you know, jobs in factories, etc. And I've just managed to get myself a job that I actually really want. and, you know, actually knowing the wage and them telling me how many leave days I've got and telling me all the benefits. And
yeah,
I think I must seem like the perfect candidate because it didn't even enter my mind, that type of stuff. It's just, if I want to do it, I'll do it. I never don't think about the rest of it. But yeah, when I joined the army, none of that occurred to me.
Yeah.
And the fact that I think I knew I had to give, you have to do 4 years. I think I did know that.
Yeah.
But at the time, that doesn't seem big to you, does it? When you when you're 16 and you want to do something, you, that just goes over the top of your head. It's just like,
again,
you know,
but then you think now of the difference, or of those 4 years in particular, either 16 to 20 or 17 to 21.
Yeah,
man, that's a lot of change and a lot of development and a lot of.
Well, this
they're parts of my life. Again, I think of 16-year-old me and 20-year-old me, and that feels like two different people.
Yeah, join the army.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll see a different one then. Yeah. Well, I think this is. Yeah, one of the issues with a lot of veterans' mental health that isn't talked about a lot. So you hear a lot about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a lot of people like high suicide rates in veterans, a lot of homelessness. And I think a lot of this can be sort of linked to training that a lot of people don't realise. So, especially at a young age. So there's been research to say that I think before you're 25, your brain actually isn't fully developed I don't know what you call it, or the professional word is.
Healthy and balanced, kind of,
But, and you're more likely to make decisions that include risk, you know, stuff like this. So when you join the military and you go through this sort of training, it's conditioning, it's mental conditioning, it's training.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's loads of things. So the values and standards of the British Army. So basically they want to get a civilian, break him down. You always hear this thing of breaking down and building him up, right?
Right.
And they want to break you down and build you up into all the same. So all with the same values and standards, so there'd be selfless commitment, integrity, respect for others, loyalty, courage, and discipline. That's the values and standards.
Yeah.
And the reason I know that is because once I didn't, and someone beasted me
right,
until I knew it, right?
Yeah.
So, but I think you can break that down into much simpler terms. And I think, in essence, what they want you to do, so they want to get a civilian with his own thoughts and his own feelings and his own ways of doing things to follow orders, but more importantly, to follow orders without questioning the orders, to be loyal to his unit, and the third one, which is probably the most psychologically damaging, is the removal of this like natural aversion to not kill. And all this is done in, like, you know, a lot of different ways, and I think these three things sort of come and go at different points and all intertwine. It's quite a mixed up thing, but so for instance, the following orders without question. You know, every military in the world practices drill, so that's like marching.
Yeah.
You know, like you see outside Buckingham Palace and stuff like that.
Yeah, of course.
So that is, in essence, a way of training people, a mass group of people, to follow orders without questioning them. So you tell everyone to stop, everyone halts, and if one person in training, for example, does it wrong, that person will be pulled out and punished.
Yeah.
But also, during the start of training, not only he will be punished, the whole group will be punished. Yeah. So there's this...
You've got that on every...
So this group, everyone, group punishment, so you do not want to be that guy that does that. And that's just at a really low level. But also, there's another thing there. This, if you are doing that and you're constantly doing that, and the group is seeing that this one person is constantly doing that, you'll then be ostracised. So,
right.
Or, if you're a good bloke, people will take you aside and say, look, this is how we do it better. Come on, sort yourself out and we'll help you out.
We'll help you along,
Or you'll be dragged into a room and beat up until you leave. You know?
Yeah.
And that's also a way of being sort of loyal to this gang. So that's kind of like on a very low level, but that sort of builds up and builds up, and there's like constant testing of this during training. So it could be anything from, like, you know, everyone jump in that ice cold water. You don't want to do that, do you? But you're following orders without question, they'll test you. Or it could just be, you know, stand now with your chin out and we'll come and punch everyone in the chin, you know. Wow. Things like that. So you're constantly being tested on this ability to follow orders without question.
It's the part of it that has always, it's the part of it that's I've always been most uncomfortable with above all else. Yeah. Weirdly, above the training to be comfortable with killing. Because again, I can kind of see more how, look, in times of war or whatever else, you can, that may be helpful. As harsh as that sounds, and I mean, to the individual, if you can train them to see it as a lighter thing, I can see how that might be helpful. The bit that makes me uncomfortable is the following orders without question, because I can't see anything positive for the individual on that.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You're not an individual. In the army, you're not an individual. And they say, you know, you're a number and you're a member of that group. You're not an individual anymore,
yeah.
which is
yeah.
another thing they do in training. You know, when you first, you get all your clothes taken off, you get given a uniform, which is all the same.
Mm-hmm.
You all get your head shaved, so you're all the same.
Yeah.
You don't get called your first name, you get called your second name.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, all of that personality gets stripped away from you, you know,
yeah.
and replaced with these values and standards or this ethos.
Yeah.
Yeah, so going on to this, like, loyalty to your gang, which is, I think, the sort of thing that leads out to what we were talking about earlier, where it's hard to, especially for veterans, to speak out on these things because they feel like, you know, they're speaking out on their group or their unit or their gang or their brothers, you know. So when we first joined training, you're not actually given your beret. So, you know, most regiments have their beret and their cap badge.
Yeah.
You're given this a camouflage hat, and that's called a cunt cap or a crow cap. So it's you want to get rid of this thing, you know.
Yeah.
So you're walking around camp with this thing that everyone's looking at. Oh, they're the new boys, you know, they're the shit blokes or whatever.
Yeah.
And also, you're not allowed to, until you get this berry, there's certain privileges you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to go to the shop by yourself, for example.
Right. Or
you're not allowed to, there's certain, I can't exactly remember the things you're not allowed to do now, but there's a lot of privileges you get once you get your cap badge.
Yeah.
So, during that first 6 weeks, you're sort of more willing. And also, you're all volunteers. You know, you've all volunteered to get there. So, you're more malleable to be put through this sort of training.
Yeah.
So, by the time you get this cap badge, you feel fiercely proud, you know, that you've gone through all this and you've gained this cap badge and you're with your, you're now with this group of brothers, you know.
Yeah, you're accepted into it.
Yeah. It's kind of like a long initiation, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so things that go on, you know, you won't speak out about it unless it's to your gang, you know, and that's seen as, and if you do, then you'll be ostracised, you know.
Yeah.
So these things, especially things that sometimes I talk about, I've taken a lot of heat off of the veterans, but a lot of times behind closed doors, they all agree with me. So it's really, really weird.
Yeah.
All the people that support me won't say it in public. For example,
that's fascinating.
Which is really strange, yeah. And I think it's to do with that loyalty to the gang, you know. I mean, I've actually got my old cat badge tattooed on my chest, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, I got that when I was 18.
Yeah.
And, it meant that much to me. This is my calling in life. This is my only thing I cared about, you know.
Yeah.
So.
But if it's not right, it's not right. It's that interesting one. So how did that all then progress? So a month after going in, you go into your training, you start off in your cunt cap, and then you get you move above that, and then what's the process after that? Kind of once the training essentially, I guess, is over, you're in, you've made the grade.
So it's essentially done in sort of blocks.
Yeah.
And it's 26 weeks is infantry training in Catterick, which is about 6 months. Yeah. And it starts off, it's basically six blocks, so intro X1, 2 and 3, and then final X1, 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Or tactical X1, 2 and 3. So, and at each one of these you can fail and go back a step or go, you know, that's another thing that you don't want to be as back squatted, that would be seen as really bad.
Right.
So you start off at first doing exercises that are, you know, fairly easier. And it essentially just builds up and builds up and builds up until you full on tactical exercise, and then your final exercise, which is like your last test. And then once you've passed that, then you're a fully fledged infantry soldier, and you get told at the end where you want to go. And actually, strangely enough, like during training, we said about all these testing things. So one of the things I did to me was so I wear contact lenses now, but I used to wear glasses.
Yeah.
And no other. Apparently, they said this to my mum afterwards, like. The only way we could get to him was by his glasses, like, because I was fit, they couldn't beast me too much, because, you know, they don't really care, I'm mentally fairly tough, but when it comes to my glasses, for some reason, it killed me. So they took my glasses off me and gave me these arm-issue glasses, which are, like, big Joe 90, like, the worst glasses you could possibly didn't suit me at all, like, falling off my face, and they did that on purpose, you know, to basically humiliate me and, test that thing again, I guess. And I ended up breaking them, and I got sent into the office, and they screamed at me and stuff, and I thought, oh, I've got away with these. I got my old glasses back.
Yeah.
And, like, I think 2 or 3 weeks later, they sent off for a new pair. But the new pair they got was even worse. Like, the old ones are black, and these are, like, tortoise shell
glasses. Wow.
And, you know, I'd be marching around camp, and all the other people that see me would be shouting at me and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. You know? I can't remember where I was going with this.
I mean, it's good, though, because that's the character in the war movie that stands out, and you're on side with him as someone watching, but... Yeah, no, that's fascinating, and it's weird, because at that point, and quite rightfully, really, I'd imagine there's an immense feeling of achievement, like when you get to that point where you've passed it all and you're fully trained, because it is an achievement if you've got to that level of fitness and capability within it all.
Yeah.
Those are things that are naturally in us. Kids love the idea of guns. Kids love the idea of fighting. If you've got to a level where you're proficient as a fighter and as using your weapon, then I can imagine that being a huge kind of I'm a man now.
I think that's actually a really good description of it. Yeah, becoming a man.
Yeah,
that is exactly what it's sort of like. You know, you've become not this training soldier anymore. You become an actual soldier.
Yeah,
I'm a regular soldier now. You know, and that's the goal you've been going to for 6 months. And you know, you put yourself through all this hell to get to, and you've been accepting of all the shit you've taken because you know that the longer goal is to be a soldier and all this type of stuff. So yeah, I think you are right. But I think I remember my predominant feeling when I drove out of the camp. I think my mum picked me up after my big parade and stuff at the end. Was just thank fuck that's over.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Like, oh my god, get me out of here.
Yeah,
you know? I just had enough and just get me to camp. Yeah, that was my feeling. So, yeah, definitely pride as well.
So, it's a weird one because, as you said, that feeling of oh, I'm a man now or whatever else. That's a 17 or 18 year old.
Yeah,
feeling that.
Yeah.
And again, that I can understand why that feeling would be the case, but I can equally understand how a short time later, there could be a big realisation that that's not the case. Well, you know what I mean? That you are still a developing mind and a developing, you know, human.
Well, another interesting thing about that is, so this whole loyalty to the gang thing, loyalty to the group, or
I
keep on saying gang, it sounds really bad.
loyalty
to the group. You're also taught or encouraged in the army to hate people below you. So,
right.
For example, the reason you want to get rid of your cunt cap is because these people above you are looking down at you. So,
yeah.
And for instance, in the infantry, we would see ourselves as like the top of the spear, you know, we're the fighting troops. People below us are called Remps, so that's like rear echelon motherfuckers. Or
right.
We just wouldn't see them as consequential, you know.
They're
fucking not, they're shit, you know.
Yeah.
And even weirdly, the people below that are civilians, you know. Yeah. So the civilians aren't even good enough to join the army, you know, the waste of space. You call them like lizards or civvy cunts or you know,
madness,
whatever, screamers, you know, whatever name you can think of for
civilian. And the logic and psychological logic in all of that is blinding, because the fact is a lot of the recruitment at schools will be targeting people who don't know what they're going to do, who are maybe, and I don't mean this in a harsh way, maybe aren't at the top of the ladder in the school system, aren't the cleverest, aren't the cool kids or whatever else. It's the ones who are a bit lost and a bit
exactly.
So to then get to have that flip round of, oh, look at them civvy cunts or whatever else. It's like, I'm now at the top of the ladder. It's such a simple and... Again, it's illustrated beautifully in that first starting point of you're the one in the cunt cap. As soon as you've not got it, it's like, oh, look at that prick.
Exactly.
It's like,
exactly.
Right, well, that was me too. But that quick illustration of that could be you, but it's not anymore, so fuck 'em.
Yeah.
Is kind of that. It makes complete sense that translates to when you've achieved your full thing, you're then kind of looking down at everyone else. I'd imagine that also comes into the helping you be comfortable with the idea of going and killing people, because you're going to be looking at most people as below you.
Yeah.
As you were saying, even other people in the army, looking at most people who are on your side as below you, therefore those who aren't on your side...
Yeah.
Fuck them. They're scum, essentially.
Especially if they're from like another culture that you can't even adapt to. And
easy to dehumanise in that way and go look at these enemy creatures as such, exactly, rather that. Than these other soldiers who have also gone through their lives and got to this point and done all this stuff.
So there's an interesting point on that is this whole movement of the aversion to kill. An interesting point of that is this manipulation of language. So, like you said, they call people targets.
Yeah.
You don't say, "Ah, oh, shoot Jim over there." You say that target over there, 100 meters away. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
On the ranges and stuff like that, things have been a lot of repetition has been done, and also the target tree has been changed from like a round circle to a human-looking figure.
Yeah.
And you can't see, and it looks like it's coming towards you and attacking you like a German soldier. I don't know if you've seen the military.
Yeah, I've seen them.
And if it's on a decent range, when you shoot it, it falls over.
Yeah.
So there's all these things that have been put in to sort of psychologically, through repetition, get in your mind to dehumanise things. And
yeah.
And words are being used to manipulate that. So
it's dark as well, because a lot of them, if hit not clean, it'll fall a bit.
Yeah.
And come back up cunning. So again, that is as simple as that is. It's like, wow, that's going to make you all the more...
Yeah, yeah. And also,
I need to make sure I get that one to make sure it goes down clean.
And it's like a competitive element as well. So if you're on the ranges, say, I don't know, your mate next to you, you want to compete with him to drop as many targets as you can, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they call, like, shooting people, is dropping them, right?
Yeah.
So it's all this like dehumanization and also
turning it into a game, essentially.
That's
the beauty of that. I know on some ranges they have the pole that has the paddles that if you shoot it spins round over to the other side, and you'll have two soldiers on one go, you're trying to clear. If you clear one, it goes onto their side, so they're then trying to clear. So it adds that pressure of,
yeah,
I need to clear mine because I don't want, and when the time's up, whoever's got the most paddles on their side is left. So again, it turns something that is an intense and deadly situation into kind of a game. It's training you to be like, no, bang, 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 it's not thinking. It's thinking I need to act as quickly as possible rather than think anything else.
And also there's like point systems. So you have to pass, I don't know what it's called now, but I think it was an APWT, so annual personal weapons test, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And you have to, and there's like a point system in it, so you could fail that test, you know, so you don't want to be failing that. There's lots of elements to it, but essentially it all exists to dehumanise and reprogram your brain. And there's I can't remember what the part of the brain's called, it's something like the amandala or something. Yeah. So it's like the oldest part of your brain, the primitive part of your brain. And I think, you know, I broke training down to three parts there, but I think probably maybe the most important part is, so the best way I can explain it is, so if you're walking through a street in London and you're stepping into the road and you see a car out of your peripheral vision, your body, this part of your brain will take over your whole body and do an action.
Yeah.
So either preserve your life or it'll just do something, you know, you'll either freeze or you'll jump out of the way.
Yeah.
But it won't be conscious thought, you know.
It's not a what shall I do now, it's happens. Yeah.
It's just bang instantly. Yeah. And or if a lion jumps in the room, you'd have an instant reaction.
Yeah.
And they say like 2% of the world would attack the lion.
Yeah.
They're like the psychopaths or you know.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And essentially what the army want you to do is attack that lion.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, you know, when you're getting shot at, everything in your body, a normal person would be thinking, fuck this, I'm off. You know,
freeze, run.
Yeah. Escape. Whereas they want the whole squad to move forward and take that enemy out, you know, actually go towards the danger.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of manipulation of this fight or flight mechanism, which all comes, all these three parts sort of intertwine and constantly testing of these following orders of that question. And drilling, constant drilling and, you know, repetition and manipulation of language. It all sort of comes into play into this one thing where you'll just go forward into danger.
So that you're programmed to react in that moment. It's interesting. I'm a big fan of mixed martial arts, and again they say that the higher level people there, or in a fight, if someone gets caught, you can see quite quickly what their main martial art is because they go to it without thinking. So I've seen a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu guys who get caught and you'll think, oh, it's over, but because what they've grown up is grabbing a leg, is grabbing an arm.
Yeah.
Their mind won't be there, and they'll be getting that locked on and getting a submission. And often in the post fight interviews, I've seen ones before where they're trying to interview and say, "So what did you think?" And he's like, "I don't know how the fight ended." like he won, but he doesn't know how it ended because he'd gone into that autopilot mode where it's just right. I'm in danger.
Reacting.
Done, it's over. And again, you'll see him regularly ask the corner before the interview, like, what was it that I hit him with? Or what caught him? Or what was it? It's like, because in that moment, it's not a conscious choice.
And I guess
choice.
That would
it's
be
the training, it's the drills.
It'd be the exact same thing, because they're probably, you know, they're in intense danger, aren't they? Especially in a very pressured position where they could easily just, if they wasn't trained and drilled and conditioned into doing certain things, they'd lose it, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
It's probably just the pressure for most people of being in front of 10,000 people watching you. Imagine being in like a school fight where everyone runs and shouts fight, and there might be 30 people are in a circle.
Yeah.
Imagine that like tenfold, and there's cameras on you and lights. Yeah. I can imagine the exact same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a guy who I was a fan of in MMA called Thiago Silva, and I always thought he just seemed so calm and relaxed. And then I saw a documentary on him, and what pre-fighting and while he was still an active fighter, he was a member of BOPE in Brazil, the terrorist police, essentially. So it's right. Like, that's why he looked relaxed in a cage, because normally he's running around in the slums with a machine gun and being shot at and all that kind of thing. So again, in a cage, he's just like, all right, I might get hit, I might not. I'm not going to get
this is much better than my day job.
Yeah, exactly. So you've done all the training, and we've talked about how training is. It's kind of a blunt question, but how's war? You know, not to be too direct, but that's what comes next. And again, it's what we do dance around in society and with children when talking about soldiers. But it's the reality. That's what you're training towards.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's all this talk of the training. Training in anything is with an end goal. Yeah. The end goal here is to go to war.
Yeah, so that's a perfect description, really, because if you'd have, for example, got everyone at the start of that military training and said, you know, what's all your aspirations be in the army? They could have said, I don't know, to earn a bit of money or to get away from this place or to, you know, whatever their motivation was. At the end of training, I think 99% of people would be, my motivation is to go and kill the enemy.
Yeah.
You know, through that 6 months of conditioning or whatever you want to call it, that's what you end up as. So this aspect of going to war becomes the only thing you think about. So from when I went to Aachen the first time at 19, so there'd have been a year and a half, 2 year period where I was, you know, doing training and stuff like that. But I was just constantly, the only focus in my mind, I didn't care about, you know, getting a girlfriend or how much money I was making or what car I was driving or what was happening in the news. All I cared about was, when am I going to Aachen? What can I do to get to Aachen? You know, that was my sole focus in life, you know.
Yeah.
That was it.
It's amazing, that was like isn't it? The pinnacle that becomes, it's fascinating, man. And that, again, it's part of the training. Part of it is necessary, I'm sure, because it's not, if you're going to be in that situation, it benefits you as an, I know you're not an individual, but it genuinely benefits you as an individual if you're enthusiastic, like if you're wanting to be there. If you're walking out thinking, oh, fuck, then that's not the ideal situation for you. Yeah, obviously, it's not ideal for the company of the military as such, but even as an individual level, I can see that. It's fascinating. I've spoken to some guys who are towards the end of their military career, and had some, honestly, some of the best guys I've met. Whenever I've met soldiers, I've gone in with the kind of thought of, these are going to be some meatheads, or that kind of preconceived idea. And sometimes they have been, but a lot of the time they've been just some genuinely amazing people. So this is my kind of flip round. If anyone thinks I've been hating on soldiers, not. There've been some amazing people, but there will then be these points in the evening where you see, again, there was one guy who was towards the end of his career, and you could see that he was really unhappy at the idea, like he wanted to go and have just one or two more.
Or drinks.
No, one or more, two more.
Oh, tours.
Tours.
Yeah.
And it was like, again, in my mind, it's like, mate, to me, the logic is, I've done my time.
Yeah.
But because it's so, but that's because I've not had it drilled into me. For him, he's like, I just want a bit more. And it's like, it's not like he was someone who was boasting over anything. At no point was, that's the thing that surprised me with all these guys as well. At no point were any of them boasting about what they've done.
Yeah.
It was all very humble and just normal conversations. And then certain stories would come up and you'd be like, all right, these aren't normal people as such. Right. But that's the thing that struck me and saddened me in a lot of ways, that there was that kind of, I'm not done yet. Yeah. I want more. And again, that's, in my mind, that's not a normal human reaction. That's a trained and drilled in.
It's probably quite similar to mixed martial arts, like you were saying. Yeah. I'm sure there's fighters there that you see him all the time. I watch a bit of UFC, and there's Anderson Silva in there.
Anderson Silva.
He's lost like a lot of his last fights.
Losing loads and keep
still
coming.
He wants to come back, you know.
Vitor Belfort and Wanderlei Silva, a load of these guys who have been there for 15, 20 years even, and like having more fights and coming back for one more. And it's exactly that, I'm sure. If you've had that adrenaline rush of having that clear physical domination, and then the adulation of the crowd, to then go to normal life, it's going to be tough, man.
Yeah.
I can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird one. I think it's like I said, it's your sole focus in life then. And also, as an infantry soldier, the only time you're actually doing your job is on tour on operations.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas if you was a car mechanic, you could do that all year round, you know, in England. Yeah, whereas an infantry soldier, you're only doing that, your job, and you're at the pinnacle of it when you're on tour. So
and you're waiting to
yeah, you're just waiting to do your job.
The expectation is huge there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So how was that when you were first told that you were going somewhere, or when you were getting your first?
Well, I was obviously really excited.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I was thinking. I think I was just really into the training. I wanted to learn as much as I could.
Yeah.
And I was just solely focused on that. And then I remember the night before I went, I think I went out in town with friends, and then getting a taxi back. I'm just thinking, holy shit, I'm going to Afghan like tomorrow. Wow. And like it hitting home.
Yeah.
Like, holy, this is actually for real. It just didn't really hit until the last minute. So mate, I think I was nervous. But then by the time you get back to your, you know, your group and everyone's back together and talking, it's, you know, you're excited again. So, you know, I don't think I was, if I was nervous, it was more nervous in a good way.
I mean, it's a great thing there as well of a fake it until you make it element as well, is if you are amongst everyone's nerves are going to be gone because everyone's going to want to not have nerves. So as soon as you're the excited one, then someone else is excited.
Yeah,
you could all be pretending to not be nervous, but because he's not, you're like, well, all right, I'm not then. And do you know what I mean? And then it turns into that excitement and hype to get out there.
Yeah. So I think I was definitely excited. And then, so you go to like Bryce Norton and you have to go and you fly to Afghanistan, and that's like a weird experience because when you're flying over there, all the lights go off and you've got to put your body armour on, then you're sort of thinking, oh, I'm actually in a war zone here, so that sort of kicks home.
Yeah.
Then when you get out of camp, you land in either Bastion or Kandahar or wherever you land. But it's just, I think the feeling I felt then, because when you get out, it's like it's a massively, I don't know what to call it, like built up camp by that point, by the time I went out. And it was like everyone was doing little bits everywhere, and you felt like a little part of this big thing.
Yeah.
I felt that was what I liked about it, maybe. Because when I went there, I felt like I was actually doing my job, and also I was part of this big machine that was doing this effort.
It was having an impact far bigger than your than you could on your own.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The sum of the parts far greater than the individual.
And I felt like I was like trained up by then. I'd had a bit of experience, well, not on tours, but you know, in training and stuff like that. I'd built up my skill set, and I just wanted to use that skill set on operations. I think that was what my feeling was, I think.
So how much of it then was the anticipation and the waiting to be sent out on something? Like, when you're there, were you straight in, or was it a lot of we're hanging out in the desert?
So my first tour was completely different to my second tour. So the first tour I did what do you call it? Basically, I was in with another regiment. So we did a tour. It was based in one place, but we go all over Afghan.
Right.
But we'd only go out on specific operations. So, say there's an operation in North Afghan or South Afghan, whatever. We'd go out in our vehicles, but we'd stay out for like 2 weeks at a time, living in the sand and stuff.
Right. Wow.
And then come back. But we was given really good equipment. You know, we only went out when we needed to. So it wasn't like we was going around just to cause danger or feeling like I was doing it for no reason. It was always for a purpose.
Here's the specifics.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. We knew exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it. And everything was for a reason. Whereas the second tour was, that was just a generic Herrick tour. And that was based in a CP, which is essentially an old Afghan farmer's house that we'd taken off him and built up into like a defensive position, really small.
Right.
And we just patrol around that area 3 times a day, the same area all the time.
Wow.
And it's just essentially waiting for something to happen.
For something to happen.
Yeah.
And that's the worst thing. That's a tough one and a terrifying one, because it's a situation, I guess that's where the training comes in, but it's a situation where you're repeating the same thing day after day, therefore it's going to be very easy to get lax, to get slack on things, but there's no exaggeration, it is life or death. It literally is life or death, but if you're doing that same route every day, it stops becoming that in your mind, I'd guess. Or it potentially could. It's just, I have to do this lap again and so on and so forth.
You never do the same route. So you're always doing different routes, you know. So otherwise they'll lay bombs in the same route you do. You do it tactically, you know.
Yeah.
But it's generally the same area that you're always going different routes. But yeah, I think, so on the first bit and the second tour, we got there. And it was summer, so it was absolutely red hot. It's like 50-odd degrees, you know.
Yeah.
And you're carrying all your kit. It's like body armour, helmet. It's just red hot. Yeah. All you want to find is shade and kneel down in the shade, you know.
Yeah.
But And when you're walking, something called a Barmer lane. So if one person walks in front and he's potentially got like a metal detector or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And what you essentially want to do if you're behind that person is walking exactly the same footsteps.
His actual footsteps.
And the person behind does the same, So we was doing patrols like this for probably about a month or something. Like you say, it was sort of getting a bit mundane. Nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And then, about a month into the tour, the guy that stood directly behind me, who was the patrol commander, stepped on an IED. And that was, I was like, well, fucking hell. So at first, like from our last tour, we got like things like RPGs. And it was weird because the first tour, we got into a lot of like contacts and firefights and stuff, but no one seemed to get hurt. It was like, it was all fucking invincible, you know. And that's what I come off the tour feeling like. I was like, fuck, I'm invincible, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you've done your training and you've become this invincible soldier. Then you'll go out there and do your job.
And then you don't get hurt and you're like, fuck, yeah, I'm invincible. I'm the man. And to go out and then see that happen, especially to the guy it did, he was like the patrol commander. He'd been in the army for, I think, probably about at least 12 years at that point. I think he was 35. But he was like the straight down the line soldier, you know, always did it by the book.
Yeah.
Everyone respected this guy. And just to see him step on the IED, it would just, and then it'd be like just a mess on the floor. So he'd like lost both his legs and his arm was like snapped off.
Fuck.
And he ended up dying and stuff. And that was the first click as to think, fucking hell.
This is real.
Yeah. And I think, and I mentioned this before, and it sounds really selfish, but the first thought in my mind was, that was nearly me, you know.
Yeah.
Which sounds selfish.
Yeah.
But that was just the first thing, you know.
It's a natural reaction. You see posts all the time with the Manchester and London things, the amount of posts you see that I was there an hour before that. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, mate, don't give a fuck. What about these, like, these people are actually jumping? It is a natural human reaction to go, oh, God, that was right near where...
Where
I was, or again, mate, that's elevated hugely in your situation because literally he's in your footsteps.
Well, I think
you know because you've stepped in footsteps. Yeah, you know he's literally or just off, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so there was three of us at the front, and he was the fourth man.
Yeah,
and so all three of us must have walked, God knows how close to this pressure pad on the floor, and he must have just either stepped a little bit out. I remember turning around and seeing him. He was like looking through his sights at something, so I think he must have either stepped off the lane or just unluckily stepped on this thing. But yeah, so I think that was kind of the first. And it was also the first time I'd seen a close colleague right next to me, you know, brutally maimed, you know, and seeing a human. And then you also realise that a human being's actually really fragile, you know.
Yeah.
Seeing someone with the legs ripped off, you almost think, fucking hell, we're actually, you're not invincible, you know. Yeah. That could have easily happened to me. And
despite how invincible you've all been trained to feel, you're still humans.
Yeah. So it was a kind of really weird one. That sort of started to make me think, actually, maybe after this tour, I might give it up.
Yeah.
You know, because no matter how good you are, at that stage, he was like, you know, one of the best soldiers in the battalion.
Yeah.
And he stepped on this idea that he had no control over.
It wasn't even in an intense situation as such. No. It was on a daily patrol or whatever it is.
So it wasn't even if he like messed up a drill, you know.
Yeah.
He was standing up out and then he got shot or something.
Yeah,
he was just,
yeah.
He was following what he was supposed to be doing. He'd done all the training and, he was gone. So I think that started to flip my mind. And then we was on patrol again, like, I think about 2 days after that.
Yeah.
So we got a new patrol commander and then... So we carried on patrolling. At first, everyone was a bit, you know, cagey and stuff like that. No one really wanted to go out. Then again, you get into that routine of doing it and doing it. And then 10 days after that happened, the guy in front of me stepped on an IED. So this guy, Andy, he now actually races cars and stuff like that. So he's a double amputee. He's got no legs. But so he stepped down in this ditch, essentially. And then I was speaking to him because we just had like a little reunion. I didn't know the full story of it because, you know, but from his side, he walked into this ditch to, you know, clear it, and he'd come back through the ditch to tell me to come over, and that's must have been when he stepped on this IED. So at that point I'd already been next to one IED, like right next to it, and I was patrolling, that IED went off, and I think I was just like, fuck. But weirdly, that whole thing about conditioning and going it forward into danger, I didn't react in like, I reacted in a weird way, like to look at it now, at the time I just thought it was professional, you know. So this IED went off and I stepped into the blast, which is strange thing to do looking back at it now.
100%.
And I took a knee, which is like, you know, normally when you stop you take a knee, you know, when you're in the army, and I stepped into this blast and took a knee, and I just sort of like sat there, and then I heard this, that Andy screaming, and that's obviously, I knew when something had happened to him. And but yeah, looking back at it now, a lot of these things that I did were completely conditioned into me, but I think that was the time then I think at that point. It needed something like that for me to click out of this yeah. conditioning and way of thinking. Otherwise, I would just think I'd have just carried on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
And again, it's interesting that they're both ones in kind of passive situations. It's yeah. not in these high intense
yeah.
firefights or anything else. Yeah. It's in. I don't know. It feels that potentially allowed it to hit through in a more grounded way.
I never thought about that.
You're in that heightened situation, it's all just happening at once. Whereas in that, it's like, wow, this is.
Yeah.
You've got time to. Sadly, you've got time to take it all in and absorb yeah. it all. You're not just, well, this is happening, but I need to stay alive. I need to do this and do that.
It's an interesting point. I've not thought about it. But yeah, I think that's interesting. Because I suppose you could, I don't know what the word is, you know, accept it. If he was in a firefight and you know, well, it could have happened to any of us, you know.
Yeah, That's the deal you've done. That's what you've signed up for, essentially. Mm. Whereas in that, it is that different thing of, yeah, there's nothing that person could have done.
No.
Particularly, as you said, with the first guy who was very much the top, respected, best of the best, disciplined, no messing about, no jokes, just and then that's the way that happens.
Weirdly, it was that first, because the second one I got injured myself and like just took a blast to the face and I got sent home like 2 days later.
Right.
But weirdly, it was the first one that affected me more.
Yeah.
The one I wasn't involved with, which is really strange.
Yeah.
So I think it was, I don't know what it was, maybe I could like see his face and I don't know what it was, but.
So what was the process of leaving?
So I got sent back from Afghan. I think I had maybe like a few months off.
Yeah.
And then went back on rear party. So when a battalion goes on operations, they leave, say, like a company of people behind to do rear party, look after the camp and stuff.
Yeah.
So I went on to that. And then I didn't leave the army until two years after that happened.
Right, wow.
Because I didn't know what else I was going to do, you know. I'd talked about it, and then I'd come home and think, well, what am I going to do? I've got nothing else to do. And then it got to the point where the battalion was going to go back to Afghan again. I knew if I didn't sign off at that point, because you have to be signed off for a certain amount of time, signed off the army contract, that I would be going back to Afghan again. And I couldn't compute it in my mind as to any reason what would be acceptable for me to go through what I'd seen other people go through.
Yeah.
I always used to think, if I was in Kev's position, looking, I don't know how to explain it, but if you know, if I was him looking down now, would I have thought that was worth it to do?
Yeah.
And I couldn't say yes.
Couldn't just,
which sounds bad, but it's not a personal thing to him. But
to
me, I just couldn't accept that was the consequence, you know.
For
reasons that I couldn't accept. So I decided to sign off, and I got out of the army 2 years later. Yeah.
Yeah. So how was it after that? How was it returning to a world you'd very much had trained out of you? I guess you know, you'd been you were now a civvy cunt.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be, on like, momentarily ignoring the horrific things that you witnessed out there, even on that level, you're now returning to being what you had previously seen as the lowest of the low.
Yeah.
So, how was that?
Well, I was saying this before, but I think, you know, leaving the army was easily the hardest time of my life, definitely. Yeah. Harder than any training I did, any operations I did. Leaving the army was definitely like the lowest point I've ever got to in my life.
Yeah.
And I think that was a sort of, like you were saying, you become this thing that you hated all your life. You become this civilian.
Yeah.
And you can't seem to, like, when I got out of the army, I couldn't even communicate with people, you know, I couldn't speak to people, for instance. And I think there's a sort of level of having to act your part, which I look back and think of now. So, for instance, I used to go to my girlfriend's, she was at uni at the time when I left, and I'd go to her room and she'd be like, oh, do you want to come say hi to my friends? And I'd say, oh, no. And she'd be like, what do you mean? That's well rude. And I said, well, I just don't want to speak to them. And she'd be saying, why? But I think the reason was because I thought that they'd have an opinion of me because I was a soldier.
Yeah.
And that I thought I'd have to be a certain way.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have to do that.
I didn't want to have to
Yeah.
to play that role.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just sick of it. I didn't want anything to do with it, you know. So that was really hard. And I think, yeah, so this level of conditioning, so you're completely different then when you get out to everybody else.
Yeah.
And you can't see why. So I never even considered anything about training or the military conditioning me. I thought I'd got out, completely unscathed. I was never going to suffer with anything.
Yeah.
I'll just get into a civilian job and I'll be fine, you know. But it suddenly started to dawn on me that I was definitely very different to yeah. everybody else, and I couldn't seem to click with anyone or any yeah. form of life.
I mean, oh, we don't call them civilian jobs. Just
exactly, you know, yeah.
As simple as that, even there. It's like, yeah, that's...
And I used to joke
there are these things that you wouldn't notice, but again, that's going to be your perception.
Yeah, and I remember joking with my girlfriend's mum. So I went to a party with my girlfriend's friends there.
Yeah.
And I'd say to my girlfriend's mum, I'm off to go practice my civilian interaction.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
She'd be laughing at me, you know. She has a joke about it now, actually. But,
yeah, amazing.
But yeah, so there was all that sort of side of it. And then there was also another side that, you know, as a soldier, I felt, you know, I was a Lance Corporal in the army. I was fairly well respected in my battalion. Yeah, I was well known. Everyone sort of knew each other.
Yeah.
And to get out, and then there was nothing else I could do but work in a factory.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what's going on here? I assumed that when I got out of the army, I'd say to someone, oh, I've been to Afghan, you know, and they'd be like, oh, instantly, yeah, we'll this, snap you
that?
Up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's nothing like that at all. I was really struggling to find any work. And I got a job in a factory spraying kitchen parts.
Right.
And I just absolutely hated it. It was just non-stop all day spraying these kitchen parts. And it was also like, so each part would have a certain time you had to spray it.
Yeah.
And you'd have to do it and mark down your time. And at the end of the day, they'd give you like a percentage of how you performed under or over. And it was just horrendous. I hated it.
Wow, yeah.
And
that would, I'd imagine, have felt like all that work and all those years hadn't even happened.
Yeah.
Because that feels like something you, if you'd been at that point of leaving school going, am I going to join the army or not? If you'd chosen not, you could be in a factory spraying parts and being given a percentage of your time. So
yeah,
again,
yeah.
I can imagine how that must be crushing to have gone through such physical and mental tests just to train and then go out and do tours and come back and feel as if none of that even happened.
Yeah.
You're now a 16-year-old, an unqualified 16-year-old again.
It's a good description of it, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
So I started doing that and I started getting... At the time, I didn't see it as depression or anything. I thought, like, my situation was crap and that's why I was unhappy. And there was loads of times where I decided, right, there's no way I can go in a civilian life. I'm going to have to rejoin the army. I think...
Yeah.
There's about three times where I filled out all the paperwork to rejoin
right,
the army.
Yeah.
Because I just thought there was no way I can live a civilian life.
Can't
you know,
this,
can't do it. And I got into filmmaking while I was in this factory, just yeah. as a side thing that I was doing. I saw this, have you ever heard of Casey Neistat?
No, I don't know.
He's like a filmmaker. He's a big YouTuber now, but
yeah.
before he did all that, he used to make these little short films.
Right.
And him and his brother are famous for doing the Neistat Brothers, which is
right.
like a HBO TV series where they filmed a year of their life, but using essentially like camera phones and
yeah.
cheap stuff
yeah, cool.
and just documented their life and made these cool little films. And I thought
nice.
That's really
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started doing that in my spare time, just things that me and my girlfriend are doing or, you know, just for fun. And then I thought, well, you know, people actually get paid to do this. I could actually do that.
Yeah.
So I remember telling people for the first time, I want to be a filmmaker, and then being like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What's this guy doing? But
yeah.
I thought, fuck it, I'm just going to keep doing it in my spare time. And then I eventually got a place in the Northern Film School in Leeds. So.
Right.
I managed to leave the factory and get in this film school, and I thought, right, this is it. This is my life now sorted. I've got this
yeah.
new direction. I can leave all this stuff behind. And then, so I did that for a year and a half. And then, basically, my mood was getting worse and worse and worse until the last lesson I had in uni, I remember being sat there, and I couldn't listen to the instructor. We were doing this editing class. And my mind was just so full of stuff. And I didn't even feel like I was there. I felt like, anyway, the best way I can describe it is imagine if you put, like, a fishbowl on your head.
Yeah.
And a thought goes out, but then it bounces off and comes
yeah,
back in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough.
Yeah,
I'm not
yeah,
good
yeah.
enough. And then another one will come out like, I should be in the army. I should be. And then yeah. imagine like 1,000 of those thoughts just going all in your head.
Yeah.
And it got to the stage where I just stood up and walked out, and I texted my girlfriend, I can't do this anymore. And she was like worried about me. And they sort of staged this like intervention, I guess, where they got me to the GPs, and I got diagnosed with like severe depression.
Yeah.
And I went through cognitive behavioural therapy and medication and stuff like that. So at that point I thought, you know, I'd my life had got to like its lowest point here, and what the fuck am I going to do with my
yeah.
life, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I've got this filmmaking thing, I don't want to give that up, I had to leave uni.
Yeah.
But I should make a film, and that's where the trailer come in. So
yeah.
I thought, well, maybe I could make a film and get this message out there of these mental conditions and stuff.
And talk about it all. And one of the things I loved in the trailer was one of the guys saying that, or taking issue with the term post-traumatic stress disorder,
cause, yeah.
And him saying it's not a disorder, it's a natural reaction to a horrific experience or a horrific circumstance. And again, I love that, and I'm a big believer in that in general. I've felt, I mentioned this on one of the podcasts a while ago, there's been some times in the last few years where I've been quite down. Now, I've not felt... I think it's easy to label now, oh, this is depression or something like that, and that often comes under the label of there's something wrong with you. Now, the times I've been down, in my mind, it's been a natural reaction to some shit stuff that's happened.
Yeah.
So it's not felt like, this is irrational or illogical. This is a logical reaction to some horrific experiences. And similarly, the struggles that you were having, that makes perfect sense. If you've been drilled to number one, or basically to have one path and one path only, as soon as you're off that path, you're going to feel lost in some way. Even if you're walking through a beautiful field, you're not on the path that you were meant to be on. You are lost. Like, when, this is sound like the weirdest example, but you're driving and you've got your sat nav and you're suddenly going along, and you know when the road's gone and you're in, like it's not updated and it's on a new road. Yeah. It can be the best situation, a wonderful road, a quicker route, but because the sat nav isn't guiding you anymore, you're like a bit on edge and a bit nervous because there's suddenly not that path there. And it's that they wouldn't have built the new road if it wasn't quicker and better and faster, but because you've not got that guidance, it's nerve-wracking and panicking.
I'm kind of, that.
Do. And it kind of it feels like that, because the fact is there, the bit where you had to have an intervention, essentially, and were at your lowest, step outside of it, you're at film school and studying film and making films. That that should be when you're at your highest.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have necessarily been able to see that because of because of everything else that was going on.
It's a really strange thing. So, like, depression, it's almost like, it's like you say, you could be feeling really depressed because you're in a situation that's shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, a close member of your family's died, you're going to be depressed, right? But with depression, it's almost like sometimes you can't explain why you're so down, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And there's no reason for it. And you know it's stupid. And you're thinking, you know, I've got things, like you say, I've got uni, I've got this stuff in front of me. Why? Yeah. But I'm just completely down. I want to run away from it all, you know? Which is really, really hard to get. Even now, I still suffer with it now, but I'm on medication and stuff. But for instance, like today, like if you'd have asked me a month ago to go on this podcast today, the first thing I'd have thought of is, oh, I hope I'd be in a good mood that day, you know?
I can never
tell when I'm going to be in my best spot, if you know what I mean. So, you know, if someone's asking me to speak at a school, for example, on this day, I think, oh, I've got to, like, so for instance, today I had a meeting to do this new job and this. So I didn't take my medication last night,
right?
Because it makes me drowsy and I can't think properly.
Because you want it to be sharp.
Yeah, and I want it to be sharp. So it does. It affects you in a lot, in some weird ways, and you just can never sort of plan ahead. Which is one thing I found of it.
I found it interesting having to do a podcast every week, because I have points where I'm really unsociable and really I don't want to interact much, and not particularly in a down way. Just I'm not in that mode. And but the one thing I've always had is an unrelenting work ethic. So the fact is, the podcast at points I think has saved me, because it's forced me, even if it's just once a week, to sit down and have an extended conversation with someone, because it's work, I've got to. And that week I might not have had any extended conversations that whole week, because again, because I'm working or doing other stuff, but still it's kind of a nice one. And it's, again, it's similar with a thing like this, where it's like, well, you know, it would booked it in as a hopefully, or again, your mind might have been, hopefully I'll be in a good place, but in a lot of ways it might make you be in a good place, because you need to be in a good place.
That's the accurate, it
forces the hand a little.
And weirdly as well with it, sometimes I'll be depressed at those weird times, so something really good could happen and the next day I'll just feel like complete shit, which is really weird. It just doesn't make any sense as to why I feel up or down, but you just, or I'll be at work and I'll just won't want to be there. I won't want to speak, like you said, I don't want to speak to anyone. And it's just a really weird, it's quite horrible to deal with. But
So we'll start to wrap things up. What's the plan with the film? And where can people find out more about you and more about everything that's that they're doing? Or before we get to that, actually,
yeah.
We've not even discussed part of the thing, part of the point of the film from what we've discussed was the belief that it's not anti-soldiers or anti-war as such, but it is kind of potentially anti the current age that you can join.
Yeah,
and the fact is, as we touched upon earlier, the brain isn't completely developed at this age and things like this, and that could be where there's irreparable damage for someone after they come out of the service.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because even now I still think in a military mindset.
Yeah.
But I think I've trained myself into being a civilian.
Yeah.
Sounds really weird. But there's certain things I do, like you said, from the ways I think about things. It's a civilian job. I still think of it as a civilian job, or just things I do or things I think, and then I'll think that's a military mindset or just weird stuff. I can't remember where I was going with this now. Sorry.
The fact that part of the belief in campaigning is to raise the age.
Yeah. So the reason I come about this sort of way of thinking about raising the age of enlistment is through. So I've just described about leaving film school and being at really low and thinking, right, I still want to do something with this.
Yeah.
And so once I started thinking, right, I'm going to make a film about this, I started speaking to people and realising actually a lot of people were going through the same thing. So a lot of the friends that I'd left the army at the same time, I'd speak to them and say, I've just been going through this. And I'd be really nervous about saying it. And they'd reply saying, oh, yeah, I've just been doing that exact same thing. I've been diagnosed with depression. I'm on this medication. I was like, oh, holy fuck. Then I did another one. After like five people that happened to, I thought, well, this is an issue, you know. No one's talking about this, but it's clearly a lot of people are suffering with it.
It's going to be heightened hugely in that situation. I've done a lot of work with Calm, and actually the event I was at last night when we were recording this is a charity called A One for the Boys, which is about getting men to talk more about their physical health and about cancer and checking yourself and this kind of thing, because it is a massive thing. Again, I've worked with Calm for years about men's mental health, because the biggest killer of men in the UK between, I think, 16 and 35 is suicide.
Yeah.
It's not car crashes or drugs or anything else, it's suicide. Mm. And that's a problem that men have at points with sharing or talking about these things. Now, if you've then, at an early age, gone through a system to make you the ultimate man, the strongest man, the least questioning and communicative man, then that's going to be ramped up to almost 100%, I'd imagine. I'd imagine it's verging on 100% of men that leave the army that struggle to talk about issues in any real way.
I actually did a series of, I think it's about 10 videos, so I sat down with an organisation called Child Soldiers International, and they said they've been looking for a veteran who joined the army young for 3 years, and each person that they've got has always said, no, I can't do it, I don't want to be, you know, on camera speaking about this stuff.
Yeah.
For 3 years, I was the first person to do it. And there's like, so if you go on Child Soldiers International, there'll be a link like, don't join at 16 or something like that. And there's a series of 10 videos which sort of explain a lot about what I've been speaking about now, really, but what training's like and, you know, the after effects and that type of stuff. And that's sort of like a resource for young people to go look at and find out the sort of truths of it. You know, I've done all sorts of stuff like going speaking at schools and telling like the realities of training. Not necessarily in a way to say don't join the army, but just to say, if you're listening to the recruiters who are saying this is the funnest, best thing ever, I'm going to tell you the other side and you can make your own decision on it, you know?
Completely, and I think that's the most important thing. It's why we started the Say Why to Drugs podcast. And again, I say in the advert bit, it's not pro-drugs, it's not anti-drugs.
Yeah.
But the point is to let you make an informed choice rather than a brainwashed choice or a fictional choice or a propaganda choice. So to go in and speak honestly, that's what's needed, right?
Yeah.
Rather than, again, I'm glad you've highlighted, because again, I think we've got it across on the podcast, but this isn't a discussion that's having a go at soldiers or the army or anything else. It's speaking openly and honestly about it.
Exactly,
Then that's then for people to make their own mind up on.
Yeah, exactly. I think, like you said, it's a really hard thing to talk about, and people think it's a personal dig at a soldier or soldiers, when it's not personal at all. You know, I've been a soldier. It's not. I've still got friends that are in the army, you know, and that's cool. But I just want to at least let people have an option where, if I was that age, maybe I would have taken a different path because I knew the effects. Maybe I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I'd like to have known them. I'd like to have someone to sit down and said, you know, I now suffer with severe depression. I think completely differently to everybody else.
Yeah.
And it affects the whole way I live my life. And,
yeah.
You know, I've seen people growing up next to me, or, you know, all these type of things that probably don't get told in recruitment centres.
But the reality of all of it, because again, it's still, a lot of people would hear that and still say, no, it means enough to me. And that's absolutely fine, but it's having that honest and open choice. And it clearly defined, I said, the fact that you went in with no idea of pay, of term particularly, or things like that. Just, I'm signing up. I'm a soldier now.
Yeah.
Of how long training would take, I'd guess. Because again, that's a.
Yeah.
I guess that's an almost open-ended thing, right? Is it training specific?
It's specific. Yeah. Right. Unless you get back trooped or back squatted or.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say because you have to get to a certain level, I'd imagine. But unless it's very right.
Yeah.
I see.
So yeah.
So where can people find or keep up to date with what you're doing and watch the trailer, for example, and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I've got a website, waynesharrocks.com, where you can go on and there's a link to a lot of media I've done and some articles I wrote if you just go on the media, but there's information down there.
That's great. So it's waynesharrocks.com, right?
That's right, yeah.
Look at that, I nailed that. I didn't even look at my phone or anything. I did close my eyes. For those who can't see, but yeah.
Yeah, so in fact, everything that you need to go, just go on the media bit for that, and everything I've done has been linked, so you'll be able to find links from.
Amazing. And are you on social media and any of that kind of thing? Or?
Yeah, so I've got a Facebook page, Wayne Sharrocks Films, and I'm on Twitter, W Sharrocks, but you know, I never use it. I need to get into the Twitter game.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
I've got, you know, upwards of 100 followers.
that's perfect. Well, thank you very much. Amazing to talk to you about all this. It's fascinating. I'll blast out some links at the time as well to the videos and stuff like that. But
yeah,
thanks for talking, man. Because as I said, it's not an easy thing for people to talk about. But even more so, as you've said, for a soldier or a former soldier to feel comfortable talking about. Because even though you're not speaking against stuff, you're just speaking openly about what happens. Yeah. There is still very much a band of brothers mentality of we don't talk about this is private, but maybe people should talk about it a little bit.
I think actually if I could say any advice to a veteran that's maybe thinking the same way I was thinking a few years ago, where I was depressed and stuff, actually talking about it openly has been the best therapy for it. Almost like it's the same thing with depression actually. When you don't know you've got depression, you're just completely confused as to why you feel like this, but when someone says you've got depression, you can then compartmentalise it and say, I'm doing this because I'm depressed.
It's a weight off your your shoulders in many ways. Yeah. It makes a sense all of a sudden.
Yeah, so if you're thinking, I'm feeling like this because I was trained into that, then it's the same thing, you know. And if you speak about it, I guarantee there'll be another veteran friend that you've got that's going through the exact same thing. Yeah. I would guarantee it, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think speaking about it's definitely the key to getting over it or accepting it or whatever.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, man. That's been an amazing conversation. Thank you.
Awesome. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. What an amazing dude, right? I think he's a wonderful guy. I hope you all go and follow him on social media and let him know what you thought of this episode, because it's an important one. And please, when I have guests on who aren't celebrities as such, it's when we really, really rely on word of mouth of you guys posting about it on social media, spreading the word. If you thought it was a good episode, I'm not asking you for anything. I'm not asking you to lie. But if you've got to the end and you thought it was a good episode, then please spread the word and share it about with anyone you feel it might resonate with. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week with the long-awaited Destiny special that I recorded partly in England and partly in Los Angeles, California. So check that out. I'll be back next week. For now, ta-ta.
Thank you. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.